concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you the best music.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number two, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
India, in conjunction with Israel and the U.S., have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians. Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise.
That's Azad Issa, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. Today, India and Israel have forged an alliance. It wasn't always that way. India became independent in 1947. Its first Prime Minister, Nehru, positioned his country as a champion of the Palestinian cause. As leader of the Non-Aligned Movement, India's stance on Palestine had great influence among other post-colonial nations. In the 1990s, that shifted. India moved into the U.S. orbit and embraced neoliberalism. And, at the same time, it moved closer to Israel. It was said if India wanted to be close to the United States, it had to reshape its critical policy towards Israel. And that they did. Today, the two countries have something in common. India's military occupation and domination of Kashmiris, and Israel's military occupation and domination of Palestinians. And India, under the Modi Hindutva Hindu nationalist regime, is the world's largest buyer of Israeli weapons. Israel, in return, buys weapons from India. Journalist and author Azad Issa says, Hindu nationalists have been observing how Israel has been behaving. More importantly, they're watching how the world is responding to it. They're noticing if you have America behind you, no one really can touch you. Our guest today is Azad Issa. He's an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. His articles have appeared in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and Foreign Policy. He's the author of Hostile Homelands, The New Alliance Between India and Israel. He gave the Hari Sharma Lecture at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, in May 2025. And now, Azad Issa.
We are definitely in perilous times. 100 wars of different types and in scale and of relevance to the international media continue to manifest around the world. Sudan, Palestine, Kashmir, Congo, Yemen, Chhattisgarh, all connected by imperialism and theft of resources, climate destruction and corporate greed, all cruel legacies of colonialism. In the case of India, the systematic degradation of basic institutions from civil society to the media and the judiciary has left an already embattled Indian democracy into little more than a skeletal outline of a dream. You would know, for instance, that Amnesty International was forced out of India in 2020 after facing harassment and intimidation from Modi's government. Likewise, you would be well aware too that several Indians with OCI cards have been refused entry into India owing to the critique of Modi. Perhaps some of you would also know that several Kashmiris over the past 5 years have been placed on travel bans pulled off planes as they're about to depart Delhi, detained, and asked to sign bonds agreeing that they would cease to write negatively about India in order to be released. This is the Modi government, we are told. But how many of us would know that as far back as the 1970s, the Indian government was revoking and stripping Indian citizens of their passports? So I hope you will indulge me as I narrate these details, but I feel that it would be negligent to speak of the present, today, and the future without acknowledging the continuities with the past. And history is so omnipresent during these times. Palestinians commemorated Nakba Day, the catastrophe of death and ethnic cleansing that came with the creation of Israel in 1948. Black activists and anti-colonial scholars will mark the centenary of Malcolm X, who was born on May 19, 1925. His internationalism and deep meditation on questions of liberation, justice, and solidarity is a radiant reminder of our interconnectedness. The issues that concerned him too, like Palestine, Sudan, the Congo, continued to burn with injustice. His refusal to back down and his ability to see through respectability politics, or what Muhammad Al-Kurd would call the politics of appeal, as a means to appease liberal so-called dialogue, is foundational to recognizing and shoving the boot of our necks. And in the spirit of bluntness, it seems paramount to be blunt about our barely recognizable planet, you know, if we are ever to ever resurface. For this, we must talk about the Israeli genocide in Gaza as part of the larger economy of oppression and authoritarianism that does not merely carry the stamp of the West. In fact, the genocide in Gaza lies at the intersection of the building of a new world order in which the powerful are able to pursue expansion, domination, and the exertion of hard power over peoples, domestic or otherwise, with impunity. And the beating heart of this new pursuit is the burgeoning India and Israeli ties. This is not bluster, not hyperbole, but for this to make sense, we need to take a step back. When members of the Hari Sharma Foundation asked me to speak today about the relationship between India and Israel, the genocide in Gaza was in full flow, and the confrontation between India and Pakistan that threatened to escalate into war hadn't erupted. At the time, there was an uneasy calm between the two countries. Beneath the so-called calm, however, existed a story of Indian expansion in Kashmir, of the Indian state accumulating and implementing Israeli models in the most militarized region of the world, of the Indian state bringing tourists to Kashmir to depict a sense of normalcy. So the events in Pahalgam, in Indian-occupied Kashmir, on April 22nd, where armed men shot dead tourists, purportedly on the basis of the religion, tased the status quo out of the stupor of what it really was about, a delusion. As per usual, confusion reigned as an armed group claimed responsibility, then denied it, citing that their online presence had been compromised. And the Indian state and its stenographers, known as the Indian media, willingly distilled the ambiguity to gift India its pretext to wage war within minutes. But not just to wage war against it, against who it deemed to be guilty in this context, Pakistan, but to use the opportunity to reinforce several myths to consolidate and unify the nation. First, that this was an attack that resembled October 7th, the Hamas-led attacks on Israel in 2023. Second, that this was an unwarranted, brutal, and heinous attack on innocent tourists by a savage ideology. Third, that this incident deserved a fitting reply that suited India's newfound brawn in a new chaotic world order. For this too, the destruction of Gaza was invoked. Television channels spoke of carrying out a disproportionate response. They called for the army to bypass red lines to do so. The news media, along with Indian leaders, leaned into the Orientalist and war on terror lexicon of barbaric, dastardly, and savage to describe the incident in Pahalgam. There were news anchors like Arnab Goswami who called for, quote, a final solution for Pakistan. Hashtags we want revenge, hashtags destroy Pakistan popped up like digital billboards on the screen. Indian film stars too, who reside in parallel universes, marked their presence at Hindutva's digital headquarters by posting a jingoistic post or two. Obedience is a core principle in Modi's India, after all. Now, for a world horrified by genocide, live-streamed in Gaza, and largely familiar with Israeli propaganda over the past 18 months, the genocidal language from Indian channels was not difficult to discern. Even in a country where it's close to impossible to generalize one community, one idea, one narrative, there were very few who expressed public opposition to India's resort to unleash a punishment on Pakistan without it exhausting diplomatic efforts first, or without demonstrating proof to the world that Islamabad had actually orchestrated the incident in Pahalgam. It relied on an energy that the young would call trust me bro variety, and of a collective antipathy of the West towards a Muslim majority country. These calls for revenge came from across the spectrum, from the far right to the Communist Party of the Marxist variety. In a context of multiple conflicts around the world, deepening economic instability in India itself, where Modi's great economic wins haven't translated into job growth, the boisterous drumbeats for war was not just vindictive, it was hysterical and dystopian. Whereas it was difficult just a decade ago to convince editors of international news media to cover ties between India and Israel, the symmetry today is so obvious it's being discussed and debated and torn apart in memes and TikTok videos. Hindu nationalists in India, many of whom endorsed Israel's action in Gaza as a legitimate war of defense, made no bones of calling for a so-called Gaza solution in Pakistan and Kashmir. This level of dehumanization of Palestinians in Gaza by Indians exerting their own fantasy of replicating the starvation of a people as they are bombed, left under rubble to suffocate, men, women, children alike, is a level of cruelty that can only be explained by mass delusion. It follows, too, the shameless support by Zionists for Israel's actions in Gaza. Gaza's destruction has been used as a cudgel, a flex by association with Israeli oppressors, is surely the mark of a sociopathic society in which cruelty has been normalized, empathy has been emptied out, and social values evaporated. And it's not only Hindu nationalists. At the other end of the spectrum, many liberals of the left persuasion, taken hostage by public pressure or driven by a deep set of jingoism that only Pakistan is able to trigger, trumped up support for the Jawans against what they seem to think was a legitimate war of attrition against the rogue neighbor. Terrorism from Pakistan had to be stopped, they argued. These attacks from Pakistan were getting out of hand, they chanted. The nationalism was deemed so important, they were willing to suspend disbelief in the very state that had become the disinformation factory of the world because it involved Pakistan. They too didn't prioritize the need for proof or due process as per international conventions before endorsing striking its nuclear-armed neighbor. Both took their attacks on the Indian tourists in Pahalgam as an attack on the idea of India. Muddled with reports, the tourists were asked of their religious persuasion was enough to label it an attack on Hinduism itself. Now, even those Indians who would have not condemned the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7th felt the need to immediately condemn the killing of tourists and call for swift revenge. They did so just as Israelis and many otherwise sensible Jewish Americans or Jewish American opponents of the Israeli occupation did after October 7th. And like their liberal and Zionist compatriots, few in India dared to ask obvious questions. The most glaring one being, are there a shortage of picnic spots in India? How is it normal for tourists to be picnicking in the world's most militarized zone known as Kashmir, where local Kashmiris live under de facto military law? Am I blaming the tourists? No. I am blaming India's occupation, which is at the root of all violence in Kashmir. Let me put it another way. Condemning the killing of tourists after they were picnicking in the world's most militarized zone and an occupied territory is to concede that their safety is more important than the people who actually live there. What is this except imperialism? But just as we've seen it done repeatedly, the chorus of condemnation took over and unified a country over the bellowing cry for vengeance. The Indian state saw it as a pretext to live out its Hindu nationalist fantasies. It leaned into the Hindutva's founding myths of being besieged and under threat from outsiders, of using the moment to reinforce a call to make India Hindu again, as they claim it was 1,000 years ago, or thousands of years ago. To do this required bluster, to project oneself as masculine and militaristic, to project a new Hindu. Naturally, this involved unleashing terror against Muslims across the country. They had to be reminded, after all, that they were not part of the nation, that they had to be subservient to survive. And so what happened? The country unified behind the goal of providing punitive action. At the state level, the state cancelled the Indus Water Treaty with Pakistan, threatening to cut the source of life to Pakistani farmers. On the local level, there were calls to boycott Muslims or Kashmiris. As one young Kashmiri girl doing her internship in Delhi told me, quote, "The auntie who used to sell me food daily stopped doing so. She denied me roti," end quote. The Indian state too found it an appropriate time, as ever, to remind its neighbors they survived on borrowed time. It called the military escalation against Pakistan Operation Sindoor. The name cuts deep into the ideological makeup of the Indian state, where a Hindu nationalist agenda, which has for decades projected itself as militaristic and masculine and modeled on European fascist movements, seeks to mark Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir as its territory. This was an allusion to the RSS manifesto of reunifying all of so-called ancient India once more. It's an assessment that has gone down well with India's liberals and the left, who say that this is not the policy of the Indian state. But India is already a country of vigilante-led lynchings, of aunties denying lunches, and the military operating loitering drones over madrasas in Pakistan. Are those the policies of the state? Why then is it so hard to believe that expansion is next in line, if both the right wing and secular nationalists believe that India is broader than its existing borders? And what is this India-Israel relationship that makes all of this even remotely possible or plausible? For this, we must consider the bedrock of the relationship, the unironic impulse to buy weapons to save democracy. India purchases more weapons from Israel than any other country and has done so for more than a decade. These arms are used by Israel and Palestinians. Then they find their way to Kashmir, to India itself, like Chhattisgarh. They also constitute a methodology of conducting operations within India. Let me provide one example. In February 2024, Indian farmer protests erupted in the state of Haryana, in which people who feed the people of India demanded guaranteed minimum prices for their yield. They were showered with lead-based pellets and as well as tear gas from loitering drones. It was thereupon discovered that the tactics used on the farmers were directly informed by the state government's visit to Israel in 2018 during the Great March of Return protests in Gaza. Back then, Palestinians were calling for their right to return to their homes outside the concentration camp called Gaza. Several delegates with the state's security apparatus, including the chief minister, said that they were looking to, quote, replicate Israel's tactics in Haryana. Now, here's his full quote. "The idea behind the visit of the police delegation is to learn from Israeli experts how to improve the efficacy and efficiency of the law and order machinery to check crime and beef up security and intelligence network of the Haryana police," end quote. In other words, as Palestinians were being maimed by snipers, Indian leaders were studying how such ideas may be transplanted into Haryana. In this case, it took 6 years to activate. This is just one example. Like that, there are others in which the Indian states, like Maharashtra, have looked to implement methods of US and Israeli homeland security among the police departments. So what about the political or diplomatic level? How do we see those ties playing out? In late 2019, following the revocation of Article 370, the Indian Consul General in New York called for India to build Israeli-like settlements in Kashmir for Hindus to essentially conduct demographic change. Quote from the Consul General, "We already have a model in the world. If the Israeli people can do it, so can we," end quote. Then there's the Citizenship Amendment Act in conjunction with the National Register, the NRC, that turns Muslims into second-class citizens and makes religion a basis of citizenship. This mirrors Israel's law of return that grants all Jews the right to immigrate to Israel and receive immediate citizenship. Then there's the extraordinary story of Delhi's support for Israel during this genocide, as countries have tried to force a ceasefire and an arms embargo onto Israel. New Delhi has supplied weapons, including combat drones and components for bombs. The weapons Israel once upon a time sold to India were now being co-produced in factories across India itself to support Israel. These include AI weapons. Then there's a remarkable request by Indian companies to India to have workers sent over to Israel to replace Palestinian workers post October 7th. Today, 12,000 Indian caregivers and construction workers have been sent to replace Palestinian laborers, now barred from working in Israel. Several Indian unions called on workers not to go to Israel, but Modi's jobless economic growth means that workers, abandoned by a system that favors predators, presents few options for those working for upward mobility. Perhaps the most telling sign of all of this is India's refusal to endorse the case of genocide at the International Court of Justice. But even as a fight continues on the international level, another fight is taking place on the cultural and educational domains. For instance, you may have heard of or even watched Fauda, the wildly popular TV series revolving around a team of trigger-happy commandos who love to kill Palestinians in the West Bank. In classic fashion, the show doesn't explain why Israelis feel so insecure, nor does it illuminate why the Palestinians might resort to violence, aside from explanations that revolve around personal vengeance and mummy and daddy issues. The Israeli commandos are shown to break the law, all in the name of saving the nation, so much so that the audience is primed to support the crimes they must commit to save Israeli society. It is the TV series that effectively manufactures consent for war crimes. The show was so successful in India that filmmakers teamed up to produce Tanav, billed as an Indian remake of Fauda, set in Indian-occupied Kashmir. This is the level of consent for Israel being hardwired into Indian society. Take the rapid moves taking place among Indian universities over the past 18 months. As the biggest student movement since the anti-Vietnam War movement has engulfed universities across the US and parts of other parts of North America, as well as Europe, over the growing anxiety over the future of collaboration with American universities, Indian universities have gone the other way. To assuage Israeli concerns about changes within their US academy towards Israel, they have approached Indian universities for partnerships. So just as Palestinian workers' losses have been Indian workers' gain, the efforts of students to popularize the call for boycott and divestment at American universities has resulted in Indian universities' gain. During the course of this genocide, Indian universities have engaged or signed a mountain of deals with Israeli universities and weapons manufacturers. These partnerships, especially in the sciences, appear to focus not merely on building new hubs of defense and technology research for both the Indian and Israeli armed forces, but also as a means of exerting influence over Indian academia. But of course, these research ties aren't all about the military. They extend to more so-called innocuous fields, like agriculture and water tech, which the Israelis use as a means to extend control and pacify through resource extraction and exploitation. Israel's USAID equivalent, I mean, the USAID doesn't exist anymore, but the equivalent, Mashav, is providing fellowships and short-term courses in Israel for Indians. Today, Indians make up the highest share of foreign students in Israel. So the attacks on Pakistan then have to be seen through the prism of an ethno-nationalist state that wants to paralyze dissent, subsume difference and diversity into a single stream of political ideological consciousness called Hindu nationalism. And to accomplish this project of mass pacification, India has turned to Israel for its expertise and for inspiration. And part of this effort has been the instrumentalization of the word democracy to achieve autocratic ends. Given that the occupation of Kashmir didn't start with Modi, that the pogroms against Muslims and Sikhs didn't occur exclusively under the BJP-led governments, and that India was a Hindu-majoritarian country from the get-go, how did India get away with projecting itself as the antithesis of belligerence and as anti-colonial? For this, we can talk about Indian soft power that characterize Indianness, of family values, respect for elders, secularism, as traditional, hardworking, and educated. We can talk about Hindi popular cinema, cricket, yoga, Ayurveda, even Kama Sutra. In this way, Indian soft power is not so different from American soft power. American soft power, too, has sought to project a country as a nation that believed in certain values. It has perpetuated ideas about its beliefs and values. It has even feigned a certain self-reflection and notion of free speech to project its democratic exceptionalism. Now, India, having exerted soft power around the world, has shown an ambition to exert its newly acquired hard power as it sees fit. It wants to be taken seriously as a power, to be leader of the G20, to be on the United Nations Security Council as a permanent member. But how did India move from being a seemingly non-belligerent, non-violent land of Gandhi and the Lotus position to one which calls for flattening of its neighbor? Who helped project India to these lofty heights? And what does it have to do with India and Israel ties? Or with India's complicity in this genocide? Again, we need to go back, perhaps now, to partition and of Palestine and the subcontinent. I cannot surely get into all the fabrications of partition, the disinformation, the myths about India, many of which have been spread by Indian scholars or through Indian popular or American cinema, but I can allude to how we got here from an incident in 1947. In June 1947, Albert Einstein at the IAS in Princeton wrote to Nehru, the leader of the Indian National Congress, asking him, as the leader of the incoming Indian government, to support the formation of a Jewish state. In his letter to Nehru, Einstein writes, "May I tell you of the deep emotion with which I have read that the Indian Constituent Assembly has abolished untouchability. I read that the curse of the pariah was about to be lifted from millions of Hindus in the very days when the attention of the world was fixed on the problem of another group of human beings who, like the untouchables, have been victims of persecution and discrimination for centuries." He continues, "I find profoundly gratifying the fact that the reconstruction of Palestine has taken not through the exploitation of native workers, the usual pattern of imperialism, but through the heroic toil of Jewish pioneers. The once malaria-ridden swamps, the stony mountain slopes, the salt shores of the Dead Sea, now fertile and blooming, are evidence of a creative impulse whose thwarting would make mankind, as well as Jew and Arab, the poorer," Einstein wrote. In his reply to Einstein, Nehru refuses to take a firm position. He declines the invitation to be a patron of the new Jewish state. He says that he's not competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. But his overall answer is quite illuminating. "I have paid a good deal of attention to this problem of Palestine. I have read books and pamphlets on the subject issued on either side. Yet I cannot say that I know all about it or that I am competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. I know the Jews have done a wonderful piece of work in Palestine and have raised the standards of the people there. But one question troubles me. After all these achievements, why have they failed to gain the goodwill of the Arabs? Why do they want to compel the Arabs to submit against their will? The way of approach has been one which does not lead to a settlement, but rather to the continuation of the conflict. I have no doubt that the fault is not confined to one party." He finishes. Now, what is particularly fascinating about this exchange, and there are many, is the level of myth-making on both sides. You have Einstein talking about the end of caste. As you know, that's false. It was false in 47, it's false today. Hindu nationalists today have themselves tried to co-opt caste into the project. Likewise, Einstein repeats myths that the Zionists built up the land, showing how ubiquitous this perception was in Zionist circles. This too is a myth that continues to circulate today. On the part of Nehru, as you may note, he says both sides have erred. And he goes on to recognize that Zionists have helped build up Palestine. Now, this is the great anti-colonialist, as many remember him, meekly saying that he does not know how the colonial project in Palestine may be resolved. It is this exchange that sets up the symbolic parameters of the relationship between India and Israel in the decades to come. Yes, Einstein changed his mind about Israel, of which much has been written. But did anyone correct him on the question of caste or of his impression of the moral compass of the Indian state coming into being. The exchange, too, showcases the level of myth-making at the heart of America's institutions. Einstein, sitting at Princeton, invokes India's purported success of eliminating caste as a means to draw India closer to the Zionist project. Likewise, Nehru, like many leftists and liberals in India, would appear to do later on, accepts this praise despite knowing that caste has never been abolished and that India itself was violently put together, including occupying Kashmir, and lets the perception settle that India was an exceptional state with a moral backbone that held it back from becoming closer to Israel. But New Delhi, like other states, designed its foreign policy based on self-interest. There was a certain currency with the so-called Third World to be seen as pro-Palestine. It didn't have the military to compete with the world powers, so it instead became a critic of it. It bided its time. Nehru and Co. allowed an incomplete narrative of Indian descent and objection to the Zionist project to grow and to thrive. It inadvertently helped bury the question of the Indian caste system in the West and elsewhere. In other words, and as you would know for decades, India has been largely and uncritically so seen as a left-leaning anti-colonial state that held Palestine as its moral center, despite its occupation of Kashmir and its violent policies towards Muslims and Dalits and Adivasis. These issues, many liberals and leftists say, only propped up recently with the rise of Hindu nationalism. But India bought weapons from Israel as early as 1962 in its war against China, under Nehru. Again in 65 and in 71 against Pakistan, it imported weapons from Israel. And as Indira Gandhi publicly endorsed the PLO and signed on to Resolution 3379 at the UN that called Zionism racism, her office was privately facilitating Mossad and raw ties. And this continues through the 80s, when the prospect of Israeli ties is increasingly tied with modernization, development, and being closer to the US. India's charge towards neoliberalism is inextricably linked with the great charge towards Hindu nationalism. This encompasses a focus on Hindu entrepreneurship and innovation and self-reliance at the cost of Muslims and as part of a politics of reinforcing a Hindu history on the story of India. And that takes off here. Here it is India's Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi, who is explicitly told by American or Zionist American groups that if India wants to be close to the US, it has to reshape its policy towards Israel.
You're listening to Azad Issa, the India-Israel Alliance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
In other words, the entanglements of Hindu nationalism and its delusions of grandeur and illusions of being a besieged people that we are seeing today in the expressions of both the support of Israel and the duplication of Zionist lies, barely fathomable deception is both the project of the so-called left and the right in India, and that extends decades. Today is no aberration. This is no coincidence. This is India, and to borrow from Edward Said's analogy about Israel and Zionism, this is India despite Hindu nationalism's impulse to conceal it. So where does it leave us? Where do we go from here? If the India-Israel alliance is not stopped, we are looking at India becoming the factory of Israeli weapons on the planet. This is to say, the mass producer of Israeli weapons. Via its hold on generational long levers of soft power, Delhi will disguise its illicit weapon sales under the rubric of defending democracy, religion, and civilization. But it will be expanding Israel's market to sell its methods and tactics. Israeli weapons are likely to emerge in more developing economies than ever before via New Delhi. And these will lean towards pacifying and controlling undesirable populations and nullifying democratic movements. Then there's the question of education, skills, and the labor pool. As American universities are struggling to justify their entanglements with Israel, so much so that this entanglement, even if remote, is actually a future possibility, Indian universities are helping build the next generation to help the settler state survive. This will help, or this will influence how Asia is taught at American universities. It'll seep into language. Criticizing India will become Hindophobia. It already has. We have to think about how Indian transnational and Hindutva organizing will see this moment, and as they often do, look to exacerbate restrictions on what is possible when talking about India or South Asia. Then there's a question of land and resources. The Indian government, too, is facilitating the takeover by oligarchic entities. Kashmir is just one place. The Adani group already owns 70% of the Haifa port. In other words, an Indian oligarchy owns Palestinian land. India, in conjunction with Israel and the US, have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians. Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise. Likewise, the UAE, the US, are deeply entangled in all of this too. How did the world look to dislodge apartheid in South Africa? It looked to isolate it. But how do you isolate an ecosystem that encompasses capital, military prowess, labor, soft power, hard power, and a market? This might sound incredibly distressing and heartbreaking, and it should be. We are facing dark times. But this shouldn't halt our ability to push for imaginative ways to lift the boots off our necks. None of what I have described are original or unique problems. Oppressors find the sadism they yearn for in each other, while the occupied find comfort in each other's resilience and solidarity. What the genocide in Gaza did was blow the lid of all the hypocrisies of the global world order. It showed kings to be Western puppets. It showed up the wealthy as wielding little more than affluence. It showed the Western press, Western cinema, tech behemoths to be stenographers and beholden to state propaganda. It also blew the lid off India's growing authoritarianism. Whereas it would have been very tough for South Asian scholars and activists like Professor Sharma to speak about India in an academy that has largely valorized India, the road has been cleared now to speak and examine the Indian state. The lack of ambiguity saves a lot of explanation too. This moment has seen other developments. 100 years since Malcolm X, we have seen one of his dreams come to fruition. As Michael E. Sawyer said last month, South Africa's effort to take Israel to the ICJ is Malcolm's dream of a colonial entity being dragged to an international institution manifest. Now, of course, we are only at the beginning of this fight, and what's left is us to decide to what extent we want to join it and how. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Azad, for this. My name is Ramana. I teach in the University of British Columbia here. I want to go back to another aspect of your biography, which is you're from South Africa. And I'm curious about two things. I mean, we know what South Africa has been doing on Israel-Palestine, and its role has been commendable. What is its view on what's happening in Kashmir and on the recent war between India and Pakistan and on the longer history? If you're thinking about what spaces we can intervene in and how we might be able to move something, one of the areas where I think there's a little bit of a schism within India is in the area of foreign policy, right? The foreign policy establishment of India does not want to completely align with the United States, right? On Israel, they'd be very happy to be aligned with it, but they don't want to be in general seen as completely in alignment. And we see that, for example, when it came to the war on Ukraine, they refused to sort of sanction Russia and things like that. And India is also, and India and South Africa, are founding members of the BRICS, right? And so that's another forum where presumably there is going to be some kind of tension between a more non-aligned version of foreign policy and one that's much more in alignment with the United States and therefore with Israel and so on. So I'm just curious what you think about if there's any tension there which we might be able to exploit.
South Africa is doing a good thing by pushing this case at the ICJ. But it's low-key complicit in the genocide itself because it's sending coal to Israel. Colombia cut the coal sort of export to Israel, but South Africa hasn't. And I suspect they would like to, but the US will turn us into North Korea overnight, basically. And I think that's the issue. But it's a hypocrisy nonetheless. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that South Africa has very strong ties with India. And I think they're unsure how to go forward with that. Okay, if we go back to 1946, just before India becomes a country and the UN was actually formed at the time, one of the first issues that were raised at the UN was South Africa's racism. And it was India who brought it up, basically. Now, it was all, this is an incomplete story as well, because India, there's always half stories with India, is that it actually raised the issue of Indian people's rights in South Africa, not black people's rights. That only happened like 12 years later or something. Anyway, but that's a half story, but still, like, that starts, you know, starts the dialogue about this apartheid state to be, because it's signed 46. Apartheid hasn't even started. Apartheid starts in 48. Now, what I mean by this is that the ANC creates very close ties as a result of that with the National Congress government, right? So these things, you know, you can't dislodge them that easily. And so there's obviously a kind of suspending of, you know, a belief regarding India, right? Is obviously they're going to sidestep India's excesses, right? I think the core of the foreign policy department in South Africa are aware of the issues in Kashmir, and I think they may be concerned about it, right? But when Pahalgam happened, for example, they put out a standard kind of condemnation. So that's just like the standard kind of discussion around, you know, the rubric of terrorism. The funny thing is that when I went to find the statement, it was taken off the website, basically. So I'm a little bit confused by that. But what I feel as if there's some kind of tension that's developing regarding these things. But Kashmir is not important to South Africa, like Palestine is, right? That we've got to be clear about it. Now, I know I'm giving you a bit of an unruly answer here, but the BRICS situation is also fascinating, because when it was envisaged, like more than a decade or so ago, you know, it was sort of spoken of as kind of like a response to the West in a way, right? And it will be economic and political. But it's kind of another club of crazy characters also, right? You have Russia there and you have China, you have, I mean, everybody else is also there now. I forget, it's like it's expanded now, right? And so one of the things about BRICS is that they've made it very clear that they don't interfere with each other's political dramas, and that has to be explored. What do they mean by that, right? And so, and India has pushed back regarding BRICS' sort of position on Gaza, right? They have pushed back against it, like subtly so. Modi didn't go to the main meeting on BRICS regarding Gaza. He skipped it, right? And so there is a tension that exists there. I think BRICS needs to be seen as a body that just wants to be their own type of gangster on the planet, basically, their response. And India, as you say, like correctly so, India doesn't want to put all its eggs with the US, but at the moment it seems to be doing a lot of that, because even with regards to BRICS, it said recently that it doesn't see BRICS as a kind of counter to the West, right? So there's a lot of changes that are taking place, and that's why I'm not so optimistic about BRICS as well.
I have two questions. One is about the role of international media like Al Jazeera. You see a lot of images of Palestinians being killed or bombed. How does India get exposed to these images? I mean, the general population, is Al Jazeera and other international agencies exposed to by the Indian people?
On the media front, they are the Indian media is extremely sensitive to the Western press. So if you write for Washington Post or you write for the New York Times, for instance, they are reading those very closely. The smaller media, they're not that interested in, right? But they are sensitive to the big media, and they spend a lot of money to lobby and also to kind of interfere to interject in that space. After 2019, they did not allow international media to travel to Kashmir for several years. I think it may have just opened a little bit now because of Pahalgam, but I'm not entirely sure. So there is a lot of effort that's made into controlling the media, international media, and a lot of sensitivity towards it. But the international English-speaking media, the mainstream one, has obviously spent more time worried about China. So because, you know, China is seen as that threat, so India kind of falls under the radar to some extent, you know, especially like the New York Times won't cover India very closely in this regard, because it kind of mirrors U.S. foreign policy. With Narendra Modi, there has been some coverage regarding like Hindutva, Hindu nationalism. That stuff does get covered to some extent, but not anything that kind of contradicts like Western interests, basically.
My question is on practice and hope, especially hope in the youth, Indian youth. We have seen youth movements around the world, like in Africa, in USA, and we have Jewish youth, like they've joined with Jewish Voices for Peace, not in our name. Do you have similar Indian youth movements against fascism in their own country?
Yeah, there are a lot of student groups that I often speak to in different parts, whether in Hyderabad, where they're in Kerala, even New Delhi. You know, they don't label themselves as sort of anti-fascism. They're just sort of like student groups that are mobilizing, trying to explain, trying to teach, trying to push back against things that are happening on their campuses. At this point in time, if anyone organizes on campus for Palestine, that's actually organizing against Hindutva as well, you know? It's sort of like Kashmiris, right? There was a stage where you couldn't put up any graffiti on the walls against India, right? But you put up Palestine graffiti on the walls, and you're basically talking about your own condition, essentially, by doing so. Now, those graffitis have now been taken down, right? Those signs are also because people caught on after a while. But in India, like, there are things that people are talking about. Students are pushing back, right? Of course, there's an incentive, again, if you are in the sciences, you know, if you are in tech, for instance, that if you want, you have to close your eyes and try to get a job, right? You're going to get a job at all these big media companies or big tech companies that are all getting, like, finances from Israel or from the U.S. Like, Israel has a huge investment thing into AI and cybersecurity and startups in India. And so if you are in tech and if you're in the sciences, you're being lured into it, right? But if you're in humanities, there's a lot more space for people to be, like, trying to imagine different worlds, essentially. But yes, there are a lot of groups that are doing things. It's not, like, stagnant or anything. People are pushing, people are trying, but people are very scared. And people, they are concerned they can be picked up at any moment, essentially. So there's a lot of times where I'm talking to someone and we're discussing something, and then that person stops talking. They just disappear, right? And it's like, because they don't know if their phones are being surveilled and all of that. So it's really, like, become, that's kind of scary, essentially.
How do you go about seeing the stories or grappling with the stories of students? And how do you represent that in international media, standing against this larger force that is Hindutva?
That's an interesting question. Sometimes they find me. They reach out on social media, on Instagram especially, to ask a question. They ask for the PDF. So we have a discussion. I do some research on them. And they've got to sort of prove that they're not a spy being sent. And then we talk, basically. And I have a newsletter. Basically, I try to get these new voices to write about their experiences. So there was one piece that came out recently. It was a Palestinian student living in India, like what it's like to be a Palestinian at the moment in Delhi. Like, it's horrific, you know? Like, you're working and living in a university that talks about, like, you being a liberal university, and suddenly everyone has abandoned you, right? Because you're Palestinian, right? So that's one. Then there's a piece coming out, inshallah, maybe tomorrow, next week, about Chhattisgarh, right? There's a huge, we don't talk about that, right? There's a huge operation going on against the the people in Chhattisgarh, you know, the indigenous people there, right? And thousands of troops going, and as everyone's talking about India and Pakistan, they're like bombing the hell out of these people, right? And so there's a piece coming from the ground regarding that. Essentially, like in that case, someone, a Kashmiri, reached out to me to talk about what's happening in Bastar, basically. And so like there's like weird connections going on, right, between these groups that are all like being oppressed, you know. There'll be someone in the US who's Dalit, who's connecting with someone in like an Adivasi activist in Chhattisgarh, who's connected to someone in Kashmir, and they pass the details, and they're looking for people to tell these stories. Now the challenge is that we don't use their names, because then they're gonna be screwed, basically, right? But yeah, now the difficulty is that the Western press are so outside the loop on so much of the stuff, and journalism is also under attack to such an extent. It's like dead in many ways, in which there's no time to be sitting with someone and talking and developing relationship. It's like you move from one story to the next story, you know. So there's a lot of dilemmas regarding these things, but that's sort of the process.
First of all, thank you so much for your discussion and talk. It was really enlightening. There was a lot of rhetoric of complicity and colonialism and expansion in your talk. Based on these elements, I was wondering, could the Indian government's realist state-building efforts and securitization under Hindu nationalism be seen as a turn to totalitarian state-building? Is this a way for India to use hard power, such as conflict with Pakistan, alliances with Israel, and the annexation of Kashmir, to mobilize its population and consolidate an illiberal democracy?
It's barely a democracy, and there's barely democracies anywhere, right? US is not a democracy either. So yeah, that has already begun, and you could say certain states are more so than others. Like certain places, UP, Haryana, these places are a lot more illiberal, if you want to call it. They're like, in a way, you can call India, like Israel is like an ethnocracy, right? It's basically just an ethnicity-driven type of place, like where one ethnic group benefits more than the other, right? I mean, it's exactly that, where you are creating a country where there's a difference between citizenship and nation. So if you're part of the nation, so you're Palestinian and you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you're not part of the Jewish nation, right? So if you're Muslim in India, you know, you're moving towards that. In many ways, in some states, it's already like that, where you are a citizen, but you're not part of the Hindu nation, which means that either you got to prove yourself continuously, like become the colonel that goes to war for India, right? So as you say, like you have to, in that way, or you have to become subservient to the state continuously, and you have to hide your Muslimness or hide your difference, essentially. So yes, so that's already been mobilized. In fact, the people are doing that in many ways. The state is not coming up with a policy that says, go and hack this person or lynch this person. The state doesn't say that, right? But it's encouraging people to do so in different ways. So you have people walking through neighborhoods in certain parts where they'll be screaming genocidal chants about the people living there, right? The Muslims living there. The Muslims may end up throwing stones at those guys. So then they are picked up and taken to jail, basically, right? And then if the proof comes out that they were provoked into doing these kinds of things, there'll be no apology from the state, essentially, because that's going to cost them politically, right? So that has already happened. It's just that because India is so big, it's not happening everywhere all the time, right? And I think we have to be clear about that. But yeah, it's, for me, it's already that illiberal, and it's an ethnocracy to me, essentially.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. He spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia. Azad Issa is an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Amy Goodman, Claudia de la Cruz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, and Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance, and for Vijay Prashad's book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sansad in Vancouver, B.C. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Vilayat Khan, raga Mian Kitori.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
The operative fact is that algorithms are the underlying technology of missile defense. Algorithms happen to be the perfect weapon for executing commands in real time to automated weapons over huge expanses of geography. Algorithms, which were shaped for war, now shape civilization writ large. Digital technologies blur any distinction between civil society and a military state that may have existed.
That's Kuhan Pakmander, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. Algorithms, the dictionary tells us, are a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by computer. Sounds innocuous enough, but hang on, it has a dark side. Algorithms can make mistakes due to biases, poor design, coding errors, or flawed assumptions. They can collect and process large amounts of personal data, which can...
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.